This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. We talk about health and healing, and it doesn't do a lot of good to talk about something out of context. We rarely add context. If we did, I believe that we would have a completely different way that we lived and thought and treated each other. Today, an entire hour devoted to this topic, and I'm going to be asking you to give your input in about 15 or 20 minutes. I'm going to have one guest today, Derek Jensen. Now, Derek has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural dissent. He writes on how civilization is devastating the environment and the natural world, and our society's denial of that fact. In sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate structure will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatened by climate change, Derek advocates a dismantling of civilization, which can include radical dissent as well as imparting wisdom to our children. He's received many awards for his writings, including The Culture of Make-Believe and the two Endgame volumes, What We Leave Behind and How Shall I Live My Life on Liberating the Earth from Civilization. Nice to have you with us, Derek.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Last evening, I watched Michael Moore's new film on democracy, A Love Story. I will give you just a brief overview for those who haven't seen it, and evidently not a lot of people have seen it. It's only grossed about $8 million, and it's been out for 6 weeks with a lot of publicity. This is not going to be one of those hits that he's had, like Bowling for Columbine or 9/11. It shows the impact of the down economy on people who live in different parts of America. It shows the impact of closing of plants in Flint, Michigan, and another plant in Chicago. It shows individuals feeling frustrated and angry that they have no options. You see them moving out, and the person says, I don't know where I'm going to live. And that is a serious problem that the mainstream media has simply not focused on. And then later, he has a few people on to talk about how we got into this myth and a brief visit to Wall Street to try to explain the contradictions. He gives Barack Obama a big pass on being in any way responsible for the mess we're in. And though he does cite that he received about $1 million from Goldman Sachs. At the end of the film, you see him walking around some of the buildings on Wall Street and putting up a crime scene duct tape as if to say, you know, these people are criminals and don't go into this building. It's a crime scene. What the film lacked, in my opinion, was a really in-depth understanding of all the component pieces. Not at all was mentioned about the Glass-Steagall Act under the Clinton administration being dismantled, which was the one protection that would keep the banks on Wall Street from becoming, casino capitalist banks. Enormous risks, enormous rewards. But then there was virtually no risk, at one point only enormous rewards, because they were no longer interested in building a sustainable America, building factories, helping support small businesses and people with home-based businesses. There was no longer this notion that of a small savings loan. It was all about the gigantic institutions that were too big to fail, and how many of those people were at Goldman Sachs later went over to take over the Treasury Department. There wasn't even a mention of the Federal Reserve, only a shot of the former head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. But no real understanding of how we got into this mess of having zero interest so people could borrow 30, 50, 100 times against a dollar investment at zero interest. There was no downside. And so the Wall Street wasn't even discussed about how much money Wall Street makes, and the fact that Wall Street does not in any way, shape, or form help mainstream. It doesn't help the people, the average American. Not today. It's just out for itself. So bailing it out made no sense, but there were no ethicists in the film. There were no philosophers in the film to discuss that we should have allowed all these banks to fail. There would not have been a financial meltdown. There would have been a legitimate correction, in my opinion, where the completely inflated value of stocks up into the 13,000, 14,000, that would have come down to about 5,000, which is the actual value of Wall Street. All this was simply neglected. Now, I'm doing a major film, a very scholarly film, and a very historically accurate film on how we got into this mess. And I'm doing it as a puzzle, taking each piece of the puzzle and putting it into place, and then describing it, understanding it, what the problems and what the solutions are. At the end of it, Michael simply says, you know, join me, and join you in what? You know, where are the guidelines? Where is a real good program that we can start implementing? Clearly, with the majority of the people in Congress being told, I don't want the stimulus package, and then they pass the stimulus package, and we don't want in Iraq, and they continue to keep us in Iraq, and we don't want our freedoms abrogated, and they take away of our freedoms, the politicians are not going to be the ones in the end who help save America. In fact, they are the problem. With very few exceptions, they are the ones who got us into this mess, and the Democrats, along with the Republicans, are now keeping us in this mess. So there was no discussion of a third party, like an independent party, of true progressives. There was no discussion about what you could do to, let's say if you're unemployed or you're losing your home, what can you actually do? What steps can you take so you just don't fall into a black hole? None of that was discussed. So, in my opinion, the movie was good in that at least brought people's attention to the issue, but these are all already issues that we're aware of, and anyone who is more progressive mind would already know all the points, and a lot more that weren't even discussed would already be known. So I don't think that it's going to offer anything meaningful to causing us to have a shift in consciousness. Now, that said, not a mention that we don't have sustainable lives. We don't have sustainable relationships. We have lost sustainable health. The vast majority of people in America today are sick, angry. They don't know what to do with their anger. There was this kind of feeling in the movie that, gee whiz, if Michael brings us all these truths, that there will be a rebellion. People will stand up, but that's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen because of the theme that he said, well, the average American wants what the rich have. It's really not true. The average American does not want the responsibility, and they would burn out if they tried to push themselves as aggressively. They're not dynamic energies. The average person is a very supportive, a very cooperative team player. They're tribal. They like family. They like simple things. Whereas the people who are generally the most successful are the ones who don't care about simple things. They don't have time for simple conversations. They're bored with life. There must be constant new and distracting stimulation. It is not making money any longer to the rich and super rich. It's important at all. It's when so many other people have as much money as you have, then no longer do you have bragging rights. So you have to find some way to make yourself seem more significant. Hence, you don't become rich, you become powerful and rich. Means you're a policymaker. People seek you out to say, gee whiz, wise sage, we're not going to question how you made your money. We're not going to question how many people suffer because of how you made your money. It's just that if you made all this money, we need you to give us your advice, like a Donald Trump. There was no mention of what we have done to the environment, what we have done to cause suffering in other countries and other people, what the free market enterprise has actually engaged in. There was not even a mention of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or the World Trade Organization or NAFTA or GATT. Nothing at all. No mention of genetic engineering, of the fact that we're running out of water, that we have states, 16 separate states in America, that the future is not sustainable no matter what we do, including California. No mention that there is a small and growing movement back towards the land and back towards a simpler, more authentic way of living. No mention of that at all. So I give you that as background because I want you to take your time now and to tell us what you see as the problems, what you see as the real solutions, because I see no real solutions of any kind for anything at all on any level from any paradigm that the government of the United States is capable of handling, especially since their idea of handling a problem is to privatize it and outsource it to some corporation that will make an astronomical profit and give crappy services, no matter what it is. And that's what they've done with the environment and everything else. So we have to do something, and we better start being realistic, because we're in denial, we're in avoidance phase, we want to turn our backs and walk away the moment a serious conversation of meaningfulness happens anywhere. We are super engaged, virtually addicted, mainstream addiction, hardline addiction to trivia. Things that don't matter, we care about. Things that do matter, we don't want to know about. Now, those are my own personal and subjective of feelings. The form is yours. Now, Derek, take us through what you see through your eyes, the problem and the solution.
Well, gosh, there's a lot of material there to cover, and there were quite a few things I was thinking as you were speaking. One of them is that there's this great line that Eduardo Galeano quotes in one of his books by one of the Brazilian generals in, I believe, the 1960s. When someone asked him how the economy was doing, he said, "The economy is doing very well, the people not so well." And I've been seeing a lot of articles lately about how the recovery is here, the recession's over, of course not a depression, the recession's over, yay, and of course unemployment's going to continue to go up. And it raises the question, what is the economy for? And who is the economy for? And that leads to the question, of course, of who is the government for and what is the government for? That there are a lot of lies that we live by. And when we were briefly on the phone a couple of hours ago, I mentioned a really fundamental lie that this culture is based on, which is the notion that the world consists of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings that are in a relationship with. And we can talk about that, and that's a huge foundational lie of this culture. But there's one I want to talk about right now having to do with, you know, you mentioned government a bunch of times. You mentioned NAFTA and GATT and all that. And one of the things that many of us acknowledge in our private lives and our private thoughts, but we don't talk about so much in public, is the fact that we don't live in a democracy. And we pretend we live in a democracy, but we know we don't. I mean, I ask people all over the country, I've asked this for years, for decades now, do you believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? And everybody laughs because it's a stupid question. I mean, of course we know that it takes better care of corporations, which don't even actually exist. They're legal fictions. And I was on a panel a couple of years ago with Bandana Shiva and Kathy Pedler, and then this wonderful, amazing nun whose name I never can remember. And everybody up on the nun has done this great anti-war work. And everybody on the panel understood that we don't live in a democracy. And a little footnote here, that people used to laugh a lot in the 1980s and 1970s because the Soviet Politburo was made up of, 98% or 99% Communist Party members. Oh, ho, ho, it's a phony democracy. But how many members of the U.S. Congress House of Representatives and Senate are made up of Capitalist Party members? Suddenly we're not laughing quite so hard anymore. It's a wonderful, I'm not the first person to comment that it's a two-party, one-party system. And anyway, so everybody in the panel understands we don't live in democracy, and everybody in the audience understands we don't live in democracy. And the nun sitting to my left was talking about her great anti-war work, trying to, to halt the invasion of Iraq. And I suddenly turned to her, and I said, so how would your work be different if you fully internalized the understanding that we don't live in a democracy? What would you do to stop the war if you fully internalized that understanding? And she turned to me and she said, I have no idea. That's a great question. And that's a problem, that a lot of us act as though we do live in a democracy, that ultimately, you know, you'll hear some account of some new horror that the government is perpetrating, and you know, whether it's 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone, or there's 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in parts of the ocean, and there's dioxin in every mother's breast milk on the planet, and we then, after we hear of these horrors, what we're always told to do next is to contact our representatives. Well, it's not my representative. It's Pacific Lumber's representative. It's Sierra Pacific's representative. It's Monsanto's representative. And there are individuals who do really good work. I had a friend when I lived in Spokane, Washington, who was a her heart was really great, and she is a state senator now. And I know that she is not corruptible. And so there are individuals, but on the whole, the system is set up to serve commerce. The system is not set up to serve sustainability. And it's like I was doing a talk down in New Mexico. I was doing a benefit for this this organization that is attempting to stop yet another toxic waste site from going in another community of poor Chicanas. And the police were consistently arresting the protesters, and they were enforcing the dictates of distant governments and distant corporations. And at one point in the evening, I said to the people in the audience, so what would happen if the police, instead of enforcing the dictates of these distant corporations, what if they instead were actually serving the community? And what if the police were enforcing cancer-free zones? What if the police were enforcing clear-cut free zones or dam-free zones or rape-free zones, for that matter? And we all recognize that that's not really the function of the police. I mean, my place has been getting burglarized a lot lately, and I went to the cops, of course, and that's what we do when we get burglarized. And I got a note from a police officer in Chicago several years ago, who was reading my book Endgame, and he said, you know, I think that you're putting too much blame on the police, which is not really true. I don't actually blame police that much. But the point is that he said, you know, why is it that, he said, police, our job is to protect people from sociopaths, and that's what we do. And I wrote back and said, yeah, I think that's a really important thing to do, but how come you protect us primarily from the poor sociopaths? Why don't you protect us from the rich sociopaths who run corporations? And then I also said, why is it that whenever there's a strike, why is it that the police come in to bring the strikers to terms? Why don't they come in and force the capitalists to terms? It's like the next time there's some sort of anti-globalization protest, why don't the cops turn around and start shooting at the WTO representatives? Because they have much more in class interest with us than they do with them. And I didn't get a response back from him. And
wonder why.
And part of the problem, this is one of those places we have blinders once again, is that we somehow end up conflating what is legal, what is the law, with what is moral. And there are many laws which are moral. I fully approve of laws against rape, for example. I got no problem with strictures of one sort or another against rape. In fact, I think they should be enforced. But just because the government passes a law that says it's okay to put certain people into concentration camps, that doesn't make it okay. Or the government passes laws saying it's okay to force people of certain colors to have passes, apartheid, passes before they can go anywhere. And before we plant at those notions, we should also recognize in the United States about one-third of all African-American males from the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. And that's a scale the KKK can only dream of. So I know I'm going all over the place with this, but those are just a few of the things I was thinking, and they all come back to, I think we really need to question the function of both the economy and we hear some talking head on the television saying, so we want the U.S. economy to grow. Well, do we want the U.S. economy to grow? Do we really want the U.S. economy to exist? What's the function of the U.S. economy? I think those are questions we really need to be asking.
I don't believe that we can talk about a U.S. economy. There is no U.S. economy. That's a myth. You have multiple economies. The economy, if you're trading just in derivatives and credit default swaps and very exotic securities, for example, you could take water, oil, gas, food, and those are tradable commodities. You can manipulate those. You can play heavy in them. You can bet them going up or going down. That's the whole economy. People make hundreds of billions of dollars a year in that economy. When oil was $47 a barrel and it went to $147 a barrel, it had nothing in the world to do with supply and demand. In fact, to the contrary, supply had actually been reduced by 1%. So therefore, the cost of a barrel of oil should have come down. Less demand, less cost for that item. So that meant that every time we had a barrel of oil sold, someone was making about $100 profit. Turns out these were people from Citicorp and Goldman Sachs. They were manipulating the commodities market. Were they reprimanded? No. Were the personal names of those people responsible brought forward? No. Was there any lectures about how in the world could you make money off oil futures when that meant that the price of oil was artificially inflated so there'd be people who wouldn't be able to heat their home this year in the winter? Or people couldn't make a trip that they would otherwise make. They didn't care. So we can't even bring ourselves as a society to hold people responsible at even a moral level, forget legal level, for how they make their money. And one of the classic examples, I just saw the list of people who've been spending time in the White House, and one was George Soros, I think 3 or 4 times. Now, Soros made his money trading in currencies. And when he shorted the ruble, over 100 million Russians suffered enormous financial privations. When he did the same thing with the peso, Goldman Sachs came in and bailed out. Rubin bailed out as a former, when he was Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, he bailed out all of the people who had taken strong positions in that currency so they wouldn't be hurt. So the Secretary of the Treasury was not working on behalf of the people in Mexico or the average American. He was working on behalf of the people who had taken positions and didn't want those people to lose their position. Hence, we bailed them out. I think it was $30 to $50 billion we guaranteed. This happens all the time. And yet, these are the people who will then go and fund left-leaning radio stations or liberal causes, and suddenly they're a hero on the left. Similarly, on the right, you have Henry Kravitz, you have Silverstone, you have Mr. Black of the Apollo Group, people who are lean towards the Republican side, conservative side, who've made massive amounts of money doing the same thing as George Soros, and even worse, taking over American corporations so you can load the corporation up with debt and then strip off its assets and cause union contracts to be canceled, cause people to lose their job. And yet you have $10 billion, $15 billion. Why would you need to have someone lose their job? What does it mean to you to make an extra dollar on a deal? So it's clearly not about the money. It's about a deficiency. These people are deficient. If you can't be happy with $1 billion, then $2 billion is not going to make you happy. You're just deficient. But we don't look at the fact and say, these people are deficient in something and they should get their act together, because they're dangerous to society. Because when you give people like Bill Gates and Bill Clinton and all these other people, Ellison from Oracle, you give them free range to be considered living gods, where no one ever says no, where they're always given preferential treatment, then you're not aware that these are just human beings, all who have had insights that have helped people, all who've had predilections that have hurt people. And we can't even be honest about that these people shouldn't be the ones guiding us, because there's no spiritual extension in any of them. It's all about money. It's all about power. It's all about fame. So I'd like for you to take this now and share with us the idea that we have cults of personality that never look at the consequences of how people make their money, where they live, the consequences of living there, the consequences of taking risks that are needless and foolish, the consequences of never asking themselves, where's my food come from, where's my water come from, what happens if I ride this snowmobile across this area or ride this dune buggy across this part of the desert, what happens? They never care. And that's our entire society, with few exceptions. I figure about 5% of the American population are living consciously and actually care about the choices they make and the consequences of those choices to nature and animals and the wilderness and each other. That means 95% don't care, don't want to know, actually will be angry with you, Derek, Jensen, and myself, if we should remind them that, hey, friend, you know, do we need a law to say you shouldn't litter? Shouldn't you just not litter? It's interesting. I was in London, and I'm walking down the street, and in front of me, some guy threw debris on the street. I think it was a cigarette pack that was empty. I had never seen this before. About six people stopped him, physically stopped him, and says, where do you think you're at? Does this look like a garbage street? We live here. This is our street. Respect it or go back wherever you came from. And they were angry. And this guy, you know, went over and picked it up and threw it in a garbage can. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, in the United States, you could beat someone half to death and people would walk by you. We just saw in Italy where a guy calmly walks up and shoots a guy in the back and then shoots him in the head. There are six people standing there. Nobody sees anything. They don't want to see it. They don't want to know about it. It's Naples, Italy. It's just entirely 100%, 1,000%, 1,000,000% corrupt in Italy. And we all know that. It's like trying to find an honest politician in Mexico or in Iraq or Afghanistan. In fact, trying to find an honest politician. We know all these truths. We're not stupid. Why do we act stupid? Why do we act indifferent? Why do we act as if we don't care? As long as it's not us getting nailed, why do we care that anybody else does, that indigenous tribes, that kids are dying, that there are 50 million hungry Americans tonight, 12 million children are going to go to bed hungry tonight, that there are 100 million poor people, that over 6 million people don't know where to live, 20 million people don't have jobs? We don't care, because you don't see any protest. You see no protest. You see nobody protesting. In the American middle class, in the upper middle class, the wealthy class. When was the last time you saw Bill Clinton or Bill Gates join a protest against anything? Can you name me, Derek? Can you name me any news anchor that actually took off the camera and microphone and says, you know something, this is important to show some support, some solidarity. Let's support this cause. Well, can you name me the journalist?
I can name some right-wing propagandists who have done that against healthcare.
Yeah. But that's politically motivated, and that is not helping a common cause
of course,
sustainability.
Absolutely.
It's not humanistic, and it's not spiritual. It is purely a political machination, and that isn't relevant.
Oh, of course, of course. A couple of things. I think that one of the reasons that... Well, there's a few things. One of the things I think is very important for us to recognize is that this culture itself has the characteristics of a sociopath, and it perceives others as objects. It doesn't have empathy. It perceives others only how they can be useful. I mean, every article you read about the extirpation of some species always has to talk about that species' economic value. The species doesn't exist for its own sake. Salmon, it's only bad they're going extinct according to all the reports we read in the mainstream media, only because of their economic value. And there's once again no empathy, no perception of the other's existence. And part of the problem is that the anthropologist Ruth Benedict tried to figure out why some cultures are good, to use her word, and some are not good. Some of them are very peaceful. The people are fairly happy. Women are treated well. Children are treated well. In other cultures, women are treated poorly. Children are treated poorly. A lot of war, a lot of competition. People are generally not very happy. And what she found was one simple rule, and it's the understanding that humans are both selfish and altruistic, that we're both self-interested and we are also social creatures. And what the good cultures do is recognize that those are not actually polar opposites, but what you do is you praise and reward behavior that benefits the group as a whole, and you disallow or you shame behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. So if I go gathering and I gather a bunch of huckleberries and I keep them all for myself, everybody in the village will tell me what a horrible person I am. That's unthinkable. On the other hand, if I go get them and then I share them with everybody, everyone praises me for that. And it all comes down, Ruth Benedict found, it all comes down to how a culture handles wealth. That if it handles what through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, then everybody in the community is going to be secure. And what you're building as you have any sort of economic exchange, what you're building actually is relationships. And if, on the other hand, you reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, what you're going to get is a bunch of selfish monads who are not in relationship. And that's exactly what we have in this culture. The fact that we know Bill Gates' name is part of the problem, because the way that a functioning, healthy community works is that you disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group. You don't reward it. And then there's another problem. You talk about how, you know, why are people not taking to the streets or protesting or for that matter, why are people not dismantling the oil infrastructure that is killing the entire planet at this point? And for that, I go back to R.D. Lang, who was quite an abusive jerk himself, but he wrote some brilliant stuff. And one of the things he wrote that was really brilliant was there are three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. So what this means within the context of an abusive family is you can talk about anything you want in the world except for the abuse that you have to pretend isn't happening. And then you can't talk about the fact that you're not talking about the fact that you're not talking about the abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And in a larger dysfunctional culture, you know, we can talk about all the trivia that you mentioned. We can talk about Brad and Angelina. We can talk about the fact that the New York Yankees are 3-2 over the Phillies, and gosh, is Cole Hamill going to be able to have a good game, and who's going to pitch game 6? We can talk about all that stuff until we just die. But we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can't talk about the fact that the social reward systems for this entire culture are messed up. We can't talk about the fact that this culture is inherently unsustainable going back for 6,000 years. We can't talk about the fact that this culture destroys every indigenous culture it encounters. We can't talk about the fact that the gold standard study is that 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. And the women I know say those figures are low. But if we just accept those figures and we go with just for sort of a quick and dirty math on this, that if there's 7 billion people on the planet, 3.5 billion are women, and if 25% have been raped, that's about 900 million. And let's go ahead just to be safe and drop it to 700 million. That's more than people killed in the Holocaust. It's more than people killed in the witch burnings. That's more than were killed in the African slave trade. And those are who are alive right now. But we don't talk about that either. And I want to go one more direction. I know I'm jumping all over, but
no, you're doing fine. You're giving us pieces of a puzzle.
Well, thank you. And I'm thinking about what you said about the guy who dropped the litter. And I have a friend who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York. And one of the things she does is she asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? And she's relentless. You know, you get in a taxi with this woman, she asks the taxi driver. You get on the subway, she asks the man on the subway. She's amazing. And her answer for this is, yeah, women have to do their work too, but one of the things that will take for men to stop beating on women is for men to stop it. And one of the ways for men to stop it is through social pressure. I heard you call your girlfriend a bitch, so I'm not going to play basketball with you. You know, you beat up your girlfriend, so I'm not going to talk to you until I hear an apology, until I know it's not happening again. And we can apply the same thing to all sorts of other behaviors, too. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, a lot of generals are considered war heroes. But the truth is that if the Nuremberg principles were applied to the top U.S. generals and the top U.S. politicians, they would suffer the same fate as the Nazi war criminals because they've waged offensive and illegal war, they've countenanced torture, they've committed crimes against humanity, they've committed war crimes, and but they're considered untouchable. And if you say that if you don't praise them, then you're committing blasphemy. You're going back to the R.D. Lang's three rules of a dysfunctional culture, family or culture. And that's one of the things I think we need to do. I mean, this is not a solution to the larger problems of this culture killing the planet, but it's one of the first things we need to do is if the first rule of a dysfunctional family is don't, then the first rule of breaking that is to start speaking out openly and honestly. It's like we always hear we're supposed to speak truth to power, and I don't remember who it was who said that he doesn't believe in speaking truth to power because those in power don't care anyway. What he believes in doing is speaking truth about power. And I think that that's desperately important. It's like a lot of my indigenous friends say to me that the first and most important step we have to take is that we need to decolonize our hearts and minds. That we need to, or to take it away, a doctor friend of mine says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And so we need to start speaking out against capitalism itself. I mean, it's insane. You were talking about all these derivatives, and the derivatives are horrible. I don't disagree with you at all. That's all really great analysis you're doing. But in addition, let's talk about the notion of owning food or owning water. It's absolutely extraordinary to me that someone can pollute a river and then cause someone else to buy water, or they can destroy the salmon and then cause someone to go to the grocery store. There was a 1830s pro-slavery philosopher who was writing to his abolitionist buddy up in the north, who was a capitalist abolitionist. And the pro-slavery philosopher said, you know, we would give up our slaves in a heartbeat if we could arrange land ownership conditions so that it was in our financial interest. And there are land ownership conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves or not own slaves. And it's very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, then that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means the only way you can get them to work for you is the point of a gun. If, on the other hand, you can get a lot of people in not much land, that means they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to go to work for you. And so my point is that natural foodstuffs also cannot survive the logic of capitalism, because salmon have to go, because why would I go down to the grocery store to buy something if I can just go to the stream nearby? And this is not just true for salmon, it's true for vegetables as well, I mean for vegetation as well. And that's another thing, it's even worse than this, because it's not like I'm buying food from a neighbor. I did, because I belong to a CSA here, but in general, I mean, what are the numbers? I'm sure you know these numbers better than I do. What is it, 4 corporations control 90% of the grain market? I don't know if those numbers are precise, but it's somewhere in there. And it's the same for the other markets, too, that it ends up that, you know, when I'm buying food, I'm actually paying ADM, Cargill, these distant corporations. That's an absolutely insane way to live. And it's...
Let me give you an example of this, Derek.
Please.
When I was growing up, I had a fondness for the farm, and my parents had lived on an Aunt Myrtle's farm down in right across the river in West Virginia from Parkersburg, Little Hocking, Ohio. And this, I'm going to guess, was about a 160-acre farm. And at one point, about 30 people during the Depression for about 10 years lived on that farm. And they were poor, but they owed nothing, and they made everything. They had sheep that they sheared for their wool. My aunt, a great aunt, was a vegetarian, thin, strong, deterministic, very dynamic energy. And I remember visiting it, and all I could see was beautiful apple orchards. She must have had 50 variety of apples. Then she had nut trees. She also had at least 7 different fields of grains. She also had in a barn that was immaculately clean, she had barrels. And these are those old 55-gallon big wooden barrels. And they were packed with different types of dried fruits. And she had a root cellar about 7-8 feet underground, all bricked. And she had wooden baskets with rutabaga and kohlrabi and parsnips and sweet potatoes and potatoes. All of the dried cold that stayed about 55 degrees produce. She also had items in the ground that were never taken out unless it was needed. And she had a cheese barn where she made cheese. She had herbs hanging in the top of the barn, and it was interesting because they were dried, and then she would put them in bags and label them, and there were hundreds of them. They were all culinary and medicinal herbs, and people would come around and say, well, I need this, and she'd go in there, and she'd bring them out a bag of herbs, give them to them. And I never saw her sell anything. Everything was bartered. Everything was traded. And she didn't have the time to do the weaving, so someone would always bring over fresh quilts, and in return, they'd get food. Now, I guesstimated, and again, I was a kid, so I don't know exactly, but I'm going to guesstimate that she was growing at any given time, and drying, and storing, about 300 different types of food products. I know that she had at least 40 different types of fruit, and she did this all herself. She directed it. I remember her being up in an apple tree shaking apples when she was about 85, 88 years old, and I'm a kid underneath, and there was apples, and I'm thinking, how is she doing that? You know, people 80-some years old, almost 90 years old, shouldn't be up in an apple tree. I'm a kid. What did I know? And it was interesting because in her home, nobody could smoke or nobody could drink, and nobody was overweight, and people were healthy, and they had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go out and milk the cows and do their chores. There had to be time each day set aside for reading religious scripture. There had to be time each day to go and help the poor. And I'm thinking, wow, when she died, no one in my extended family wanted anything to do with her property or the lifestyle. And what was interesting is just across the road from her was a farm about the same size that had been around for over 100 years, that they did it just the opposite. They only had one crop, corn, and they got so much per bushel for their corn. They grew it once a year, the rest of the year their land was fallow. And so therefore they didn't have to do all this, but they also had to go to the store to buy their eggs and buy their bread and buy their milk and buy their salad greens. They were completely dependent upon the extended commerce because they chose not to be self-sufficient. And throughout my life, I would always appreciate the idea that here was this little, very strong-willed, spry lady who didn't need anyone to tell her how to live, and she didn't care about anybody else. She never had a television. She had a radio, but no television. But I never saw a person pack as much life into 24 hours. And then I would go up to my in-laws on Sundays and with my nephews and nieces, and our family would play canasta after Sunday meal after church. And they would sit there and smoke, and they'd drink coffee and eat sugared desserts. And all of them ended up with either diabetes or heart disease or cancer. None of them lived a long life. Most died in their 60s and they weren't healthy. most of them couldn't walk a block. And yet not once did they ever question the sustainability of their choices, their lifestyle. They were in their comfort zone. They were in predictable patterns. Now, you look around today, and you look at the people losing their homes. Now, this is what struck me by Michael's film. And I'm not saying this is a criticism of Michael, because he's made a contribution just by raising our awareness. But what I am doing is I'm asking people, you're out of work? Yeah. Do you know who's responsible? Yeah. Corporate America. Is that the same corporate America you're angry with? Whose cheeseburger you're eating from McDonald's? Whose Coca-Cola you're drinking? Whose cigarettes you're smoking? Whose sneakers you're wearing? Whose shorts you're wearing? Whose shirt you're wearing? Whose jacket you're wearing? Whose television programs you're watching? Whose commercials are motivating you to go to a mall and buy what you can't afford? Is that the same corporate America you're angry with, friend? Yeah, that's it. You know, you can choose another lifestyle. No, I can't. As if I wake up today and I'm a victim. Yes, but look carefully at what you're a victim of. Over to you, Derek.
Well, I think that we can certainly make lifestyle changes to help. Excuse me, I have to cough. We can certainly make lifestyle changes to help lessen our dependence upon these distant corporations. And I think that that's an important thing to do. And I think that there are other steps we can take in addition to that that are really crucial.
Okay, take your time now. We have 9 minutes. Take us through all of the positive changes that will allow us to have a more authentic, a more natural, a simpler, and a better quality of life.
Well, one of the difficulties was really explained by, there's a great book by Robert J. Lipton called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he wanted to know how it was that men who had taken a Hippocratic Oath could go work in concentration camps and death camps. And what he found was that most of the doctors actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do whatever they could to help improve the inmates' health, everything except the most important thing of all. And so what they would do is they would give them an aspirin to lick if they're in pain, or they would hide them from selection officers if they were sick, or they would put them to bed for a day or two. They would give them an extra scrap of potato. They did everything they could except for question the existence of the death camp itself. And that's a wonderful, the book is perhaps, it's one of the three or four most important books I've ever read, in part because that's what I see all the time too, that as an environmentalist, as an activist, I see myself and I see so many other people, what we do is we're doing everything we can to protect this or that piece of ground or to protect this or that species whom we love, or to do whatever we can except for questioning the foundation, to question the existence itself of this whole death camp culture, this culture that's turning the entire world into a work camp and then a death camp. And I think one of the things we need to do is to separate ourselves from this, and this can be on every level from the smallest to the biggest. It's like a friend of mine called me up and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. I was like, ugh. How much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I said, I got troops? And my point is that separating just on that little small scale of saying, it's not me. I'm not Weyerhaeuser. I'm not deforesting. I'm not the U.S. government. I didn't invade Iraq. I need to separate myself from that and make my loyalty with the victims of this culture and with the natural world. And that's another part. As I was doing this radio interview, it was just horrible. It was this right-wing property rights uber Allah's Bible thumper from San Diego or from Santa Barbara, and he was just horrible. And I was talking about how the salmon are getting hammered and sharks are getting hammered and that 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, backs every mother's breast milk. And he was saying the same thing again and again, which is, you know, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world. And I thought I was talking about the real world. But then I realized that for him, the real world is industrial capitalism. And That's the thing that can't be questioned. So when we see so-called solutions to global warming, what they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism, as opposed to taking the natural world as a given, and any social system is that which must conform to the real physical world. And it's a stunning conceit. And so my point is that one of the first things I think we need to do is to really separate ourselves from it and to say, I'm not the problem. I'm going to be part of the solution. And that is to recognize that the problem is the entire system itself. And yes, individual corporations are part of the problem, and individual sociopaths are part of the problem, but the larger problem is the system itself that has been, and to recognize the pattern that when you first think of Iraq as the first thing you think of, plains and hillsides with cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's how it was prior to the beginnings of this culture. That one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting Iraq. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. And to recognize that pattern and to look at what is wrong with this culture, that it has been destroying land bases and destroying people for a long time. So that's one thing. And then the next thing is that individual lifestyle choices, I mean, I live pretty simply myself, but that's just because I don't really want a lot more. That's not a political act in and of itself. I mean, nobody thinks that doing compost piles, which I have compost piles, and I love them. I love watching stuff decay. That is so fun. But that's not a political act. That's not an overtly political act. Nobody thinks that having compost piles would have stopped the Nazis and would have stopped apartheid or that individual choices would have helped bring about the civil rights, the voting acts or civil rights act or would have made women's suffrage. But one of the things we need to do is we need to begin organize politically. We need to figure out what it is we want, and then we need to start organizing politically and militantly for what it is we want. One of the things I want is I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. So dams need to come down. There are 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we only took out one of those 70,000 dams a day, it would take 200 years. To take out just those 70,000 dams. Salmon don't have that time, and sturgeon don't have that time.
Derek, we're going to ask for calls now. Your turn. Give us a call, 888-873-4643, 888-873-4643. My guest, Derek Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N. He is an author of important books, including What We Leave Behind from Seven Stories Press. By the way, I published with Seven Stories also. I was their first author.
Oh, cool.
And How Shall I Live My Life on Liberating the Earth from Civilization? The website is Derek, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N.com. Let's see if we have some calls up now. No calls? Okay. Final thought here, Derek, before we come up to the end of the program. I believe that we have experienced in the last 14 months a financial coup d'etat in the United States. I believe I can prove it. I believe that there was complicity between the White House and the ruling elite and on Wall Street, including Goldman Sachs, but not limited to them. I believe also that we are very close to having a military coup d'etat. But first, Obama is equivocating on every promise he made about not engaging in these wars. He tried to, you know, sugarcoat this by saying that it's the war we need to be in. No, there is no war we need to be in. And these are all artificially constructed engagements. But I believe that he is afraid of the military-industrial complex and the capacity they have to make him look weak, make him look uncertain, which is they're more than capable of doing when these generals start appearing on television. And we already know that these generals have been hired and stoking the fuel of animosity towards anyone who would want to demilitarize the planet and our nation building in the process. So when the President of the United States may have higher principles but is acting on lower political and survival instincts because he saw that economic coup d'etat, which he participated in and is still participating in, and then we see the military and the control they have, it doesn't bode well that our legislators, who continue to support these special interest groups, are going to even understand the concept of sustainability. They're once again going to say, oh, you're one of those global warming, you know, nut jobs, or one of those vegetarian nut jobs, or one of those, you know, organic nut jobs. Well, hello, compared to what? Compared to you? I would be happy to have a moniker that I'm different, as long as I am different in a way that honors people and nations and forests and rivers and streams and salmon and deer. You don't. And I don't think that we have anyone right now at the national level who has the media coverage to challenge these injustices. We only have the alternative media. And much of the alternative media is not itself balanced. Your final thought.
Wow, a lot of subjects again. And I don't actually disagree with you at all about the economic coup d'etat, because I would also say it's a series of them. I've always been kind of surprised that the sort of right-wing patriot people haven't freaked out a lot more and accused all of the politicians of treason for what they did with NAFTA and GATT, and that's a clear subversion of national sovereignty. And they complain, you know, there's a big sign maybe 80 miles from here in southern Oregon that says U.S. out of U.N., and that's sort of the right-wing cry, but it's like, my gosh, you know, it should be U.S. out of NAFTA. And those are... I mean, so yeah, I think that there are any number of coup d'etats that way, and it's very interesting. My sister is fairly right-wing, and she and I agree that the U.S. is even a semblance of a democracy actually won't last very much longer.
Well, I hope not in this form. We're out of time. Derek, thank you very much for taking this hour.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, me too.
Derek Jensen, my guest. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all. And go to the Progressive Radio Network to look at all the other dozens of outstanding programs with people who have your interest first and foremost. It's not right, it's not left, it is progressive.
City Studios. The producer is Richard Gale. Engineer is Frank Papik. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp, and our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. The program director is Jody Lennon. Sneaking.